Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Bloomberg's exclusive interview with a political hacker and how it reveals the shady and shadowy side of modern-day elections. This was the first time that someone from this field ever spoke to the media, and what Andres Sepulveda had to say will probably surprise a lot of you. Just so you guys can reference it in full, the article that I'm talking about is entitled How to Hack an Election, and it was published on the 31st of March. It's pretty long, but every word is worth it. What it talks about is how Sepulveda, a Colombian hacker involved in this business, if you can call it that, would offer his secret services to clients all across Latin America, with one of the main examples that's talked about being Mexican President Peña Nieto's campaign in 2012. The hacker, who is now serving time behind bars in his native country, alleges that the campaign paid him to steal information about their opponents from their rivals' political databases, among other crimes. Some of the other things that he says he's capable of doing in general are launching social media campaigns to affect voters' emotional dispositions. So pretty much we can say that he's a postmodern political emotional engineer and spying on political opponents using sophisticated technology. Like a true hacker of his times, he talks about using Bitcoin and international servers to cover his tracks and avoid getting caught. And when talking about the Mexican president's 2012 victory, he even speaks about how he physically destroyed the server evidence that was in his possession. There are many more details within the text, and I encourage you all to read them and see exactly how these operations work. But analyzing this all from a broader, strategic perspective, it's clear to see that information war, both its physical and psychological components, is alive and well, and that it's entirely possible that not only political campaigns, but even intelligence services are employing the use of these so-called political hackers in order to hijack democracy for their own means. Prior to Bloomberg, the well-known and respected information outlet's explosive reporting, anyone who even alleged this possibility would have been tarred and feathered as a conspiracy theorist. But now it's proven that this is in fact going on, and actually has been for quite a while. And the cases mentioned in this article are likely only the tip of the iceberg. You can bet that when the U.S. talks about countering Russian propaganda and all those other high-sounding and supposedly lofty goals that it publicly proclaims, that it's really just announcing its willingness to beef up its political hacking capabilities all over the post-Soviet space, and even in Russia itself. It's no longer a conspiracy. This is real life. This is how intelligence agencies operate, and make no mistake about it. The U.S. has a monopoly on political hacking, and is calling the shots all across the world. The next one up are the war game exercises between the U.S. and the Philippines, and how the Japanese military is stepping out of its Northeast Asian region in order to get in on the anti-Chinese action. Like I wrote nearly a year ago for Oriental Review, one of my non-Sputnik outlets where I publish lengthy and comprehensive analyses, the U.S. would end up using the Philippines as its second unsinkable aircraft carrier to, as it puts it, contain China. The archipelagic nation is at sharp odds with the People's Republic over the South China Sea, and the U.S. is taking advantage of its former colony's competition with China in order to promote its pivot to Asia. Part of this deals with conducting provocative war games all across the region in order to aggressively send a message to China, which is what the current war games are meant to do. The 11-day exercises are called Batlikan, and they happen every year, this time involving 5,000 U.S. troops, 4,000 of their Filipino counterparts, 55 U.S. aircraft, and a handful of Filipino ships and jets. Also, the Philippines will be handling a new U.S.-supplied anti-aircraft gun called the High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, or HIMARS, which will be deployed on the western island of Palawan. Another thing that needs to be said is that the training sessions come amidst a time when the U.S. is reacquiring military access to the Philippines through the so-called Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which allows the Pentagon to use five bases in the island nation on a purportedly rotational basis. Furthermore, Japan has wanted a slice of the action and has sent one of its newest and largest submarines at the exact same time as these war games are taking place, obviously sending a strong anti-Chinese message, even though Tokyo officially denies that this was the intent. It's very important to observe what Japan is doing, because it's pretty much been unofficially delegated as the U.S.'s lead-from-behind partner in containing China all throughout Northeast and Southeast Asia. Only Tokyo has the capital and political commitment to do this in a complementary fashion alongside Washington. It can't do it alone, but when Japan and the U.S. combine forces in doing so, they maximize their individual destabilization effectiveness and create a sum that's much greater than the total of their standalone parts. That's actually what this is all about, folks. The U.S. teaming up with big-name and small-name allies like Japan and the Philippines in order to form a quasi-NATO-like organization that will provoke China and do the same thing in Eastern Eurasia against Beijing that it's doing in Western Eurasia against Moscow. Same pattern, same actors, same targets. It's the unipolar world and its allies against the multipolar world and theirs. And the new Cold War is engulfing the entire Eurasian Rim as the U.S. tries to wrap a militarized and interconnected strategic noose around Russia and China. Third in our countdown are the constitutional coup attempts in Brazil and South Africa, and how the U.S. is trying to target the weakest and non-Eurasian members of BRICS. The lack of geographic and domestic political commonality between these two countries is more than made up by their shared strategic and institutional commitment to multipolarity via their membership in BRICS. However, both Brazil and South Africa, like many developing countries, are also plagued by corruption, and it's the politicized use of anti-corruption mechanisms that's being exploited to foster regime change color revolutions against these respective governments. Back in September, I wrote an article about Pakistan for the Russian Institute of Strategic Studies, a think tank that was personally commissioned by the presidential administration here in Russia and is referenced by decision makers inside the country. And within it, I wrote about the emerging concept of what I term Color Revolution 1.5, which is the use of anti-corruption and civil society tools to engineer regime change operations. I first caught on to this development during the Electric Yerevan Color Revolution probe attempt in Armenia last summer, and as an expert in the field who has even published a book on these techniques, I knew that they were evolving and would eventually be perfected to the point of being used against the BRICS leaders, which is what's happening in Brazil and South Africa now. The situation of both countries is domestically different, but what the regime change forces have in common is that they're trying to stage constitutional coups to bring pro-American forces into power and break up the BRICS from within. President Zuma of South Africa just avoided being kicked out of office after the Supreme Court found him guilty of corruption. So thankfully, he's safe for now. And the U.S. and its allied NGO and sympathetic domestic forces will have to revise their plot and figure out another way to remove him from the presidency. But in Brazil, as Pepe Escobar has been regularly informing the masses about, the situation is different. And the right wing looks ready to oust President Rousseff on the grounds of a one-sided, narrow, and politically manipulated investigation into the car wash corruption scheme. Guys, this is Color Revolution 1.5 in full effect. And if it fails to achieve its desired objective, but some of the more zealous and regime change obsessed forces transition their campaign into an unconventional war through, let's say, armed rebellion, insurgency, or even urban terrorism, then that, folks, is what I call hybrid war, the phased transition of a failed color revolution into an unconventional war. It's uncertain whether the U.S. will go that far in either case. And even if it can fully control all the regime change forces that it's unleashing from its Pandora's box of destabilization. But one thing is for sure, and it's that the U.S. has its sights set on toppling the BRICS leadership, and it wants to do so by hook or by crook. Our runner-up are the Panama Papers, and how this latest Infowar bombshell can be directly traced back to the Soros Foundation and USAID. So guys, it's what the mainstream media seems to be talking about, but for the absolutely wrong reasons. The West is making a big deal out of the Panama Papers, as they've come to be called, trying desperately to implicate President Putin in them somehow. But you know what? His name wasn't even mentioned one time in all 11.5 million documents. How's that for a pathetic InfoWar fail? Well, we also have the fact that the Americans, nor any big-name banks, are involved, which is all but statistically impossible if the Panama Papers were a genuine leak, because so much back-alley global commerce goes through them. So what's going on, and what exactly are the Panama Papers? Well, let's look at the outlet that published them, and which as of the 7th of April has yet to even provide a tool for the public to read the supposedly primary source documents themselves. Keep in mind that all that we know about them are the subjectively described summaries written by over 400 full-time journalists in around 80 different countries. Well, the publisher is the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And guess who they're partially funded by? George Soros and USAID, or in other words, one of the U.S.'s most wily and top-placed color revolution engineers, and a CIA front organization, among others. I mean, how could it be any different, folks? The NSA specializes in hacking this sort of information and manipulating documents and data. After all, they ran their first test study in the Republic of Macedonia by doing something very similar in order to provoke a regime change operation there, which is still actually ongoing. And that's what the Panama Papers are, folks. They're an InfoWar bombshell meant to provoke resistance to certain targeted governments, implicating allies with actual corruption in the larger well in order to make it seem more believable, and then use the intelligence-connected NGO network to provoke anti-government demonstrations against others. Already, the government in Iceland has fallen, and this was the only government that jailed bankers for their role in the economic crisis. All this, guys, is part and parcel of the new Cold War, as weaponized information, as manipulative media meant to smear global leaders, harm their reputations, and make it easier to mislead their constituent citizens in large-scale hostile manifestations against them. Protests which could easily descend into riots on command and Euromaidan urban terrorism at a moment's notice. Don't get me wrong, folks. There's a virtue in exposing real corruption, but manufacturing documents, shielding the U.S. but not even mentioning it, politicizing the process, cooperating with proven regime change actors like Soros and USAID, and creating a foreign media-supported push at overthrowing democratically elected and legitimate governments, that's just wrong and shameful and a disgusting distortion of what anti-corruption crime fighting should actually be. It is, to put it in context, a spark that's meant to start the hybrid war process by beginning a color revolution that in some countries and contexts could even turn into an unconventional war. At our top spot, we've got the flare-up of violence in Nagorno-Karabakh and what it all means in the context of the new Cold War. Everywhere you look online, there's one side promoting its version of history and ongoing events at the expense of the other. And it's not for me, who is neither Armenian nor Azeri, to take a side here. Nor is there any point in me trying to do so, and joining the multitude of activists on both sides who are fighting their information war. What I can do, however, is apply my analytical insight and understanding of geopolitics and giving you all a fresh view of what's really happening and why, as well as to where it could all be headed. So, having said that and issuing a clear disclaimer that I am not getting involved in supporting one side or the other, we can objectively say that the government of Azerbaijan is not as close to the West as people think it is, nor is the Armenian government as close to Russia as some would also think. I wrote an extensive analysis for Oriental Review, which is available online and on my Facebook page, but I document how Baku has dramatically chilled towards the West and equally warmed up towards Russia over the past couple of years, especially the last one, while Yerevan, despite being in the Eurasian Economic Union, is still flirting with the West and insistently trying to reach a free trade agreement of sorts with the EU. So, all that I'm saying here is that the situation is very complicated. Simple analyses don't suffice, no matter how stereotypically true they might initially seem. Furthermore, Since both sides are close to Moscow, Yerevan with its 102nd Russian military base, CSTO membership and Eurasian Union membership, and Baku through billions of dollars of arms shipments, a positive bilateral investment environment, and NASA's strategic energy cooperation on the state company to state company level, we can also conclude that neither has anything to gain from starting a hot war in Nagorno-Karabakh. While President Aliyev did speak with Kerry lately, and Erdogan did voice his support of his country's historical ally in the Caspian, if it was fully true that Azerbaijan was talked into waging a unipolar interested war, then why did it hold back from using the billions of dollars of high-tech weaponry and missiles that it's accumulated so far? Why the restraint? I mean, after all, Russia's CSTO defense obligations to Armenia do not extend into Nagorno-Karabakh, which Moscow, we need to remind everybody, officially recognizes as part of Azerbaijan. What's the reason? Well, if you end up reading my analysis, I argue that the U.S. exploited the two-decade-long fog of war along the line of contact in Nagorno-Karabakh in order to push both sides into an uncontrollable escalation that would eventually draw on Russia to everyone's ultimate strategic detriment except the U.S. The U.S. is trying to spin a web of proxy conflicts around Russia's borders, which could tempt Moscow's militant intervention to quell, and these include Donbas and Crimea, Nagorno-Karabakh, and the Fergana Valley in Central Asia. Thankfully, as regards the Southern Caucasus, the two main antagonists pulled back from the brink, at least for now, and agreed to a ceasefire in Moscow, proving that neither wants an all-out escalation and that they're aware, as per Russia's guidance, that doing so would only play into the U.S.'s ultimate destabilization plans. Okay, guys, so there you have it. Once more, we conclude this week's exciting episode of Context Countdown. Thank you very much for tuning into my program, and I always welcome you guys to share it on social media. Thanks again. I hope all of you guys have a great weekend, and I hope you'll tune in again to my show next week. Take care. Bye.